Location, the lab. Quentin only has 24 hours to sell his car. Is that even possible? He goes to Carvana.com.
What is this, a movie trailer?
He ignores the doubters, enters his license plate. Wow, that's a great offer. The car is sold, but will Carvana pick it up in time for...
They'll literally pick it up tomorrow morning. Done with the dramatics?
Car selling in record time.
Save your time. Go to Carvana.com and sell your car today. Pickup fees may apply.
There are some people who have something we require, and we want you to get it from them.
You ever kill anybody?
I hurt somebody's feelings once.
You labor or management?
If I was management, I wouldn't have given you a secret.
Who and how many are going to be coming after us?
You worried about saving your own skin?
Yeah, I am. It covers my body.
You just can't hold out forever. Impossible.
Oh! Almost a bit of raspberry jam right there, eh?
What's the color of the boathouse? And here for
I don't like your attitude.
The color of the boathouse.
Oh, fuck off!
Welcome to Row Men, a 12-episode miniseries on director John Frankenheimer's 1998 espionage thriller, Ronin, starring Robert De Niro, Jean Reno, and of course, written, quite controversially, by one David Mamet and J.D. Zeick. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and we are at scene 5, episode 5 of Row Men. We start our scene at 31 minutes and 23 seconds, all the way up to 41 minutes and 19 seconds. And I'm joined by two of my, I guess, most staunch and enduring supporters and encouragers of all of our cinematic deep dives. We have internet trailblazer and newsman, the man machine behind Dark Horizons, Garth Franklin, and the, I guess, poet laureate, the senior encourager, the instigator of all of our madness, the legendary movie mind that is Stu Coote. So, let's dive in with the boys and find out what it's like to go to new locations, to do some on-the-ground reconnaissance, and most importantly, to encourage locals to take a photo of me and my fake wife, Natasha McElhone. Let's dive in. Let's start with you, G. Garth Franklin, Ronan. I believe you... Your most recent take, you sent Stu and I a text. Can you recount what you were recalling and thinking of fondly as you were rewatching Ronin for the first time in God knows how long?
Oh, it'd been probably about 8 years. And the first thing I thought was, God, love her, you know, the practical movies. It's just all shot. So bang, bang, bang right there. There's no CG, none of that crap. And then, of course, it's just... the 90s touches and all the stuff with, you know, all the men who look like late 90s Robert De Niro and all the women who look like early 2000s Robert De Niro. Europe.
God, the effects of World War II are still clinging in the late 90s.
I mean, there was that scene right at the beginning where they're in the bar and there's the old lady, like they're trying to get sort of usher her out and she's like, she just looked like she'd been peeled off the sidewalk.
I love this movie. Yeah, I love this movie so much. It's funny, I caught this. I mean, we're all of a similar age. I remember seeing this when I was 17 in the cinemas. And for the longest time, this was always, I think, for our sort of early and pre-internet sort of film nerd kind of things, that this was your thing you would say in groups of like, oh, but have you seen Ronin? And it was always like the eyes would widen and everyone would always probably talk about the car chases for the most part. Then when you go back on it, you're like, oh, they're probably not as great as you remember compared to the rest of the action. They're still insanity given, like, you can see the stunt people diving out of the way and the drivers going, like, long side of the road. Like, the choreography
some poor bastard dresses De Niro shooting a rocket launcher off his shoulder out of a sunroof. You're like, I hope that guy's alive because that was insane.
Oh, the way he was like jarring left and right, and that's just, I don't. Oh, geez.
Crazy.
So we thought we all latched onto this. We're probably all a little bit too young for when it came out, and it was sort of, it was out of time and place. And now when I watch it, I just get this real sense of depression because really the equivalent nowadays we're getting is like the Russo brothers Gray Man. Like just everything is just, it
Yeah.
feels like it was all shot in Atlanta. Like Garth says, it's like all completely green screened within an inch of its life, to the point that there it just feels so clinical and so pristine. To that
Yeah,
point, it just
there's a great
everything.
meme that's being shared. There's a great meme that's being shared recently because as we're recording this, it's around the release of the Electric State. And a guy said, you know, how much does the Electric State cost? Does it cost more than a loaf of bread? Yes, it does. Does it cost more than, and he listed like Pulp Fiction, The Godfather. He listed like, so like, I think the IMDb top 10. And he's like, no, it costs more than all of those. It costs more than 200 paranormal activities. And I was like,
Yeah,
whoa.
we've talked about on your shows, there are these sort of, there's the last of the films that feel like they're reaching back to certain eras. So I think like very much like this feels like it's reaching back to those 70s sort of action films. Something like, as we obviously, we all three of us touched on with Master and Commander, feels like it's clinging to the last of those like big epic movies in that, on that
Well,
scale.
1998
Sad.
was a big year for that, actually, because Mask of Zorro was also that year. That was the last
Oh.
sort of big summer blockbuster Western that didn't use any CG. And
Yeah.
then you kind of had that turning point in around, I think, around Pirates of the Caribbean, probably, which is very, very early 2000s. That's when it's sort of like, oh, this is where the effects are really taking over.
Pirates and I mean, Lord of the Rings is so practical, and so much of
Yeah.
what makes it so perfect is the fact that New Zealand, you know, there's a great Los Angeles documentary called Los Angeles Played Itself, which is all about the cinema that is shot in Los Angeles and all of the genres that are very specific to Los Angeles, the city. But I feel like Lord of the Rings is almost like New Zealand plays itself for so much of it, and then it does have these big flourishes of CG and things like that. But so much of the what amazes you there, but it's like right in that pocket of like there is a big difference between, say, I think it's 1995's Cutthroat Island by the great Rennie Harlan, a movie that is deeply underrated in my mind, to Pirates. Like the jump between that practical, crazy, you know, making explosions on an island somewhere, maybe in Malta, and then what Pirates does with that a few years later is pretty stark. So yeah, Ronan is like John Frankenheimer's it's like his get back reward for salvaging anything out of the island of Dr. Moreau, which was a famously chaotic thing. So yeah, seeing him get that paycheck back and getting him to go and do something with it is so unbelievable that he's like, this is the movie I want to make.
And it still remains probably, top 20 all-time ensemble cast that you just look back and you're
I
like,
mean,
and they're in it, they're in it, and they're like, how did, how did you get everyone? And also just that, like the joy of casts that are over like three people, like
yeah.
just when you just have like, and every scene, like we're going to look at the hotel scene and you're like, oh, that looks like an actual sort of working hotel. Like nowadays, everything just has every hotel they go to, and this could just be the way sort of hotels have evolved generally around the world, that they, but now we just always get shot in this very bland sort of televisual style, whenever someone's doing stuff in a foyer, everything is again so sterile and so corporate. You go
Yeah,
back
it's
to
just
this.
they had the quick establishing shot of the hotel on the outside and then bang into the
Yeah,
inside.
this still has, the bellboys dressed up, and it
Yeah.
feels like you can feel the history in the room, and it doesn't, there's, it's doing a lot of the heavy lifting, to the point that and on top of that, you've got just bodies in motion everywhere. I just miss, like, they're going to the park, they're going to the hotel, they're going to like cafes, and they're always just flooded with extras, which I really miss that about the 90s. That sort of just like fill the screen with like a hive of activity. Makes a big difference.
One big thing I found with the difference watching it this time was because so much of even the movies nowadays have converted over to the TV format where it is there's a lot of like long scenes for character, which is all fine and good and that sort of thing. But in these sort of movies, just that efficiency of the screenplay with the dialogue, there is not a word wasted at all. Like, not a single scene is let to go longer than it needs to. It's all kept tight. There's no fat on this thing whatsoever. And it's
And through that, no one feels precious when they're talking either. Like, no one feels like they're talking in overly scripted terms, and like not every phrase is a sort of a witty sort of repartee. It all feels very lived in and natural at the same time.
Well, yeah, but that's sort of Mamet. So with the Mamet screenplay, he's famous for sort of two things. One is that he hates exposition, so he kind of avoids it wherever he can. And the other is he always says that there's no such thing as character. So character is what you infer from the dialogue and sort of set up and from the scenes. And he understands very much it's the visual medium, and Frankenheimer is very well aware of that too. And so it's all told, all these little quirks and things are told visually, not all. There's no explaining about anything. We don't need any sort of crappy backstory. There's hints of backstory, but even those are like, you're wondering half the time if any of it's real. Jeez,
It's
no.
it's a huge thing, and Frankenheimer has an absolute gift in everything that you watch. And I recently, and I feel like I'll mention it throughout the series, but I was recently watching The Manchurian Candidate, which is probably arguably his masterpiece. And there are so many wonderful characters in like an army, an army team sort of ensemble, if you like, as these different characters float back in from the beginning of the film to the end, and you see some of these like brainwashing scenes where they're all in the same scene together. And Frankenheimer just knows how to stuff a frame full of people doing interesting things or not, and you just are obsessed with what are they doing. And in this movie, at the scene that we're starting, so the scene boundaries are kind of the 31st minute, 31 minutes, 23 seconds, and 41 minutes, 19. And we're at the new location. We've gone into Nice. We're seeing the team actually getting ready, gearing up to take this case. And just the opening scene there of like Deirdre's in the bathroom and Stellan Skarsgård's like tinkering away on his computer and Jean Reno's like polishing a gun and De Niro's like looking over plans and the great driver Skip Suddeth is like, I think that's how you pronounce it. I'll probably mess it up a thousand times in the show so far. But Skip is just like cooking some eggs for the team
The apron
in his
on, or
apron.
with like the
Yeah,
towel
he's got a
coming
little
down.
apron
Jeez,
and a dart hanging out of his mouth cooking eggs for breakfast. I'm like, that's, you don't need to say anything. It's just like he just puts them in the frame, and then there is an engine, like dialogue engine. What has to happen? How do we get from this scene to the next? What makes sense? And because this happens, the very sort of South Park, much more the Mamet, it feels like he follows that kind of thing that's now been popularized by the South Park boys, like that no scene travels, no scene truly in a screenplay should move if it's an and then. You can't just say and then this happens and then. It's like it's all
This
the
was
because this happens. So because De Niro wants to get another look, that's at these guys and see how they're in action and scope them out, they go to the hotel. So it's this beautiful thing of like he has to do this moment to motivate how we turn the page and get to the next beautiful part of this scene, which is great. But I love that he's just like got them all doing shit. And that's what's such a lost art of like, there's so many moments preceding this where like there is a main, I guess, protagonist for a scene. And then in the scene, people are doing business all in the background. And you're like watching, what the hell is Jean Reno doing back there? You're like squinting, even on a 4K. You're like looking for what the hell's he doing back there? And you just get a sense of these people. It's amazing. And so yeah, I think the hotel where we end up here is one of those truly beautiful, great espionage movie pieces of tradecraft that I think a lot of people would say that it's one of their favorite things. Taking Deirdre, trying to make Natasha McElhone not look like she's completely a smoke show for like 10 seconds.
Got to dress up like Edward Scissorhands, like
She's all dressed up, and then we go to this hotel, and there's this beautiful, beautiful moment where he's reconnaissance. It's
it's
brilliant.
that bit in the park though where she is dressed up. It's hilarious. She's just so uncomfortable, on the visible on the face. It's like, the most uncomfortable pearl necklace since a Diddy party kind of thing. It's not. It's.
Listen up. You're my wife. Be who you want to look like. Just a game. Just a game. Man and woman going for a walk and all that that entails. Piece of cake. Relax, relax, darling. You look good cleaned up.
Venus, welcome. That's the hotel.
At the villa. Why are they down here? Fun and games? Pretty girls and beer or what?
Bonjour, monsieur. Oui. Pour la chambre 324. Monsieur, dame, bonjour. Puis-je vous aider?
Non, on regarde le menu.
Ah bien.
I love the camera work there. It's so simple. And we almost get like a, as they're coming down sort of the main driveway to the hotel, that almost goes into like a sort of POV shot. Almost that sort of first person view. And it's sort of very dynamic. And it's a great way of just drawing you right into their perspective as well. And it's sort of, it's very close to the cut where you have like, where he looks down into like his little guidebook and he's got the, like the insert of the photo there. I just really like those touches as they're sort of obviously playing the tourist couple, which has been done 1,000 times. But I just always love in films when it's the person narrating as well, like in the disguise, like keep it like, you know, there's a bit of a heist with that, with like the Ricky Jay character, like just don't do anything, just stay cool, like just stay cool. No one's really looking at it. And it shows that it's a nice touch of showing her nervousness for all of whatever action she's seen. She's obviously a handler, but it sort of seems still very green in the field, as it were. And then to that lobby, like when they're walking through and it's like showing the bloke, I love that because I think it's probably, again, the change in technology in all these years since 98, that people used to do that to people. Like they would show you how the camera, it wasn't out of place to be like, there'd be so many people like you'd have to show them either how you reset the film each time or how you used to click it to reload it or what button to press to actually take it. And I love that.
I feel like we've gone back there though, because sometimes I look at like my cousin's kids' phones. They're like, take a photo on this. And if it's not an iPhone, I'm like, what the hell do I press? Like, where do I press on this? And I'm so like Apple pilled. I can't do it. You know, it's an adorable touch.
The thing I love as well is when he's like, because you just know that if someone was recanting these photos at a later date for family and friends, when he goes, here, you take a photo with my wife, and he gets the guy to jump in, you just know they'd be recanting and going, oh, yeah, who's that guy? Oh, he's the guy that took the other photo. We just thought we'd get a photo of him. Who's that guy to do that? Like, who's that guy? Oh, yeah, he drove us to the airport. He got out and took a photo with us at the end. Like, it was, I love those little touches.
Excuse me. Do you speak English?
A little.
Could you take a picture of me and my wife? It's very easy. You press like that. Very easy.
Sure. Yeah.
Like that. That's it. Focus like that. Okay. We're going to do it over here. Could you get that palm tree in?
Yeah.
We want to show her on the Riviera.
How many do you want?
Just snap away.
Okay.
Right. Again, get the background. Take a couple of my wife. Just take a couple of my wife alone.
It's such a great way. And I love where he's like, and the background, and the background.
And the background. And then I love how he doesn't trust that he's taking the background. So he's like, no, you take a photo with my wife. And so he's,
yeah, just to be double sure.
Just want to make sure.
But again, just the way it's all set up to like go and like just lean the sign and then go and tip the bellboy and say, like, get my luggage out of here really quickly. Mm. It's just the way they sort of inform the audience at all times. There's no one like, at no time does he have to really say anything except just to lean it slightly and just trust the audience that it's going to pay off. In what? From when they start taking the photos to when they're darting out of there and they're recounting how good this team is, it's what, maybe 24, 25 seconds? It's not a great deal of on-camera time from when they're setting it all up.
Alone.
take one picture of you with my wife, one picture with you. That's it.
So, 10 minutes to not only establish that we're in Nice, to introduce the whole crew, to have them deliberate about this and require an up-close and personal reconnaissance mission because they're still not sure of the numbers. Then to go and do this whole orchestration, watch De Niro wear one of the ugliest orange turtlenecks in human existence, and then do the scene and then go, okay, yeah, like, let's go have another look at them, you know, one more
they're
time.
Good. Let's That's go to 10 the weather, weather now. Yeah.
It's 10 minutes. Wow. This movie flies. When I remember even just deconstructing it for this show, I was just like, what I've learned is, it's so funny, you boys being here is probably the best place to make the point. It's not as conducive to a minute by minute watch in that the impressiveness is not what is stuffed into the minutes, like something like Heat or All the Presidents. What I've started to really relish in Rome In is looking at, man, look at the economy of the storytelling in short chunks, like in scenes and sequences in this movie, because of how much they can do. It's like they're whole episodes of shows that we would be so used to now. Like, I would rather watch Ronin 100 more times than The Day of the Jackal. And I actually quite enjoyed it despite Eddie Redmayne's awfulness. But this is a whole show. This, you know, you can see people taking chunks of this if they were adapting it. And this would be like a whole hour episode. It's 10 minutes of the most economical storytelling you've seen.
But it just there's inertia to it though as well. Like, there's inertia to the narrative that just constantly, there's not really a ticking time bomb as such, but there's like, all right, we're going to meet in a day, we're going to meet in 3 days, they're moving and meeting up, and there's this constant, like, a bit like that Sicario in that way, that you sort of never really feel like you've got much of a handle on whatever is happening, except you know we'll just follow these guys to the next, and you know you're with experts, so you think you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
But again, that's a mammoth thing. That's this whole stuff. You see it in some of his other films, like Heist is another one like that. Spartans is the same thing, where you're learning the mission as it goes, and it's all about the efficiency of that sort of stuff. And the thing re-watching it for me was, I always remembered it being a sort of fast, sort of efficient movie. What I was shocked was is that first half is how efficient it is, like how tight that whole first half is. It does lose it a bit in the back half hour or so.
I agree. The back end when Jonathan
tries, once Skarsgård nicks up with the stuff from that point on, it kind of loses it a little bit.
Becomes a bit too bombastic. It almost becomes silly and sort of, you know, when De Niro's sort of throwing it all away, just, you know, when all the reveals start happening and it's like the crowd scene, that's fine. It sort of becomes quite frayed, which I think you guys
nailed it though. Why this movie holds true for me through, and I agree, the first half is just like, if you're talking about the most rewatchable bits, it's like, if you start a little bit later, you're like, oh, maybe I can turn this off. But if you start in the first like minute and you see De Niro only speaking French, you're like, oh, this has got me for like at least an hour. Like, I'm not moving wherever I'm sitting.
Yeah.
Whereas what I like about the later stuff, especially, is because like they're so efficient when they're on the job, but then when they get betrayed, it's them constantly being behind the eight ball. So nothing's ever prepared. It's like everything is the plan B and C. It's like, oh, I've got to get this, you know, ex-CIA guy to like track someone's phone for me. I've got to get to Arl. Oh, Seamus is another factor coming in. Deirdre double-crossing them. I get shot, you know, got to go and, you know, do some beautiful DIY surgery and stuff like that. And then you get like 11 minutes of the Paris chase, which is like crazy. And then the movie ends 20 minutes later. Like, it's just like, it's like, it's so like, when you're like, oh, it slows down a bit, when you're like, you look at the time, you're like, actually, this thing just keeps moving. It just keeps going and getting bigger and crazier.
And to that note on the DIY surgery, this film is in the pantheon of
the kidney dish.
They dropped into a kidney dish. This is in the pantheon for sure. Yeah, I think touching on where Natalie and De Niro are in the car when they're sort of putting the villa, when they're putting them to bed, I think there's a glimpse there of the De Niro that I really like, the sort of the shitbag, sort of mean streets, sort of the comedic De Niro, which I think, you know, I was watching a 7:30 interview, ABC interview with him the other night for Alto Kings. And nowadays when people interview De Niro, he's not even selling the movie. He's just sort of this bumbling old man who sort of goes off on his on tangents talking, a bit like myself. But I really miss I miss that sort of cheeky con man vibe that he had going sort of through Midnight Run, that sort of era, that sort of almost a bit naughty. And I think that came out in that scene in the car. It sort of, there's the flash of it where he goes, oh, me too, when he's talking about how he got into the business.
How'd you get started in this business?
A wealthy scoundrel seduced and betrayed me.
Same with me. How about that? Take out the man. Take out the man.
And you got that. That's the charming devil that I wish we saw more. I think as this, as sort of other things in the 90s, Heat, Casino, it was always the like, the very statue, I'm not going to give up my emotion, I'm the guy in control, that kind of thing, which fine, it was working and it was, he was, you know, they're still brilliant films, but I really miss that sort of the cheek that he can
well, this is sort of the halfway point between those films and the sort of outright comedies he did, which were much more just a little too silly. Whereas this is kind of that kind of middle thing. But the thing I do remember with this one is with this, when they wrote it, it was there was the original writer who wrote most of the story and stuff, J.D. Zoek, what his name was?
Yeah, J.D. Zoek.
And then that's when, and then Mamet came in, and the whole thing Mamet did was a big part of his thing was De Niro's dialogue. I do remember that very specifically when I was covering the movie. It's one of the first films I covered, funnily enough, in the site.
Wow.
But, yeah, I saw the screening of this.
Oh, God. Who was in that screening? How many people?
I can't remember. It was one of those ones where I think it was the very first year I did media screenings and stuff. And I do remember the very first media screening I ever did was Man in the Iron Mask and then
Good
Mercury
movie.
Rising.
And Mercury Rising.
Mercury Rising. but this was one of those ones where, like, this and Out of Sight were two films where I was like, whoa, this is amazing. Yeah, I love this business. I love my job. That kind of thing. And it's
this and Out of Sight are just, like, capital C cool movies.
Yeah.
Like, these are the reason they're
also there. Films built on great casting, great scripting, solid direction throughout the whole thing, efficiency, all good.
De Niro's 88, De Niro's 88 to 98. Let's just mention a couple. Actually, let's go to 87. So he goes Untouchables, Midnight Run. I'm missing a couple in here. There are more, but Goodfellas, Backdraft, Cape Fear, A Bronx Tale, Casino, Heat, Sleepers, Copland, Jackie Brown, Wag the Dog, Ronan.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
I missed shit in there too. Like, but
I still think his Jackie Brown is his one of his most underrated performances. Like the way what he's doing comedically in that, like that's the guy.
Lewis,
I'm sort of talking.
Lewis,
like it's so good. But that is what I miss because I think he's tried to touch on it back like much later, like in the most recent years where he's done sort of that bad grandpa movie, like the Zac Efron one where he really leans into the crassness, which is fine because it's just playing, I guess, against type now and he's playing all the genteel things like, you know, the intern and things like that. It's just, I think that scene just really captured for me. There was that guy that was, the chemistry that those two have on scene is brilliant. I mean, she's a rock star of the 90s that I think elevated nearly every single person's game that she appeared opposite, yeah, right?
Natasha McElhone, it says on her IMDb, it's like, what is she known for? And three of the four are Solaris, which is Soderbergh's remake of the classic, Ronan, and The Truman Show, which...
Yeah.
I mean, her, like if you even just went back, like she's... If you even went back, like there's so many movies and like TV movies now, she's like very steadily working. But in that early kind of like a late 90s period, she's got an unbelievable like resume. So she's got like the Solaris is 2002. She's in The Devil's Own, which is not a bad movie, but it has a very bad Brad Pitt accent in it. I will defend it to my death.
You can't find it anywhere. It's incredible.
Truman Show, then Ronan, and then she does Solaris in 2002, but she's just kind of all over the place. And then she has like a fair size break. She's in Californication, the series. She's in lots of episodes of that for a chunk of time.
Yeah, she was mostly in Halo recently. I remember that. It was the last thing she was in, I think, and also maybe The Crown.
Yeah, The Crown and Halo, yeah. She was in there. Yeah, two of her most recent ones. But yeah, she's around, but
She's done her share of dogs as well.
Oh, yeah.
I remember some bad ones.
Some dogs in there. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Clean Me Softly. Oh, my God. They had the Graham and wrote it, the bondage one. Like.
We'll just park that, put that on the old watch list. What's happening? Let's not jump to conclusions here, team. Okay, let's be open minded. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I love this movie. I love talking to you guys about these kind of movies. And I think that, yeah, like when I watch this, there is just such, there is a classic, you know, John Frankenheimer was making hundreds of episodes of live television in the 50s before he got his shot to make movies, and then went on to make the biggest movie, like some of the biggest movies ever. Like if you think of like Black Sunday, it's like
Manchurian, yeah.
Manchurian,
Deliverance, wasn't him, yeah.
Oh no, but he wasn't Deliverance, but like if you go through his resume, you've got films like and you literally have to go down like a chunk. Like he made films like Grand Prix, one of the great racing movies he made. Obviously, Manchurian Candidate, Birdman of Alcatraz, which is another classic. Yeah. Seconds. Yeah. I mean, this guy made French Connection 2 before he made Black Sunday. Black Sunday was a movie that shot at a real Super Bowl.
You got me onto that via imprint, and that's incredible.
It's an incredible.
Black Sunday, yeah.
To watch him have some money and bring some of this like late 60s, early 70s panache to like a contemporary production. It's just like he has a skill set that other people don't have. It's like Sidney Lumet. Like all that way, those guys had a very similar trajectory in many ways as far as like making live TV, having to reinvent yourself and then do it. So it's just he's a special filmmaker. And this film, I think the older I get, the more I love it. It is completely my speed. It's like, what do you want to do this weekend?
It's squarely in the dad movie category.
Oh, it's dad movie hall of fame, this one. It's just like, what do you want to watch? I want to watch all my favorite actors talk in like hieroglyphics and shit talk each other and smoke cigarettes and love their boyfriends, you know? I just want them to have platonic love relationships with bearded John Renault. That's what I want. Is that too much to ask?
No, it's not.
Not at all.
That concludes episode 5 of Row Min, our Ronin series on One Heat Minute Productions. If you want to follow what's happening with us, go to oneheatminute.com or at OHM Pods on all of your socials. I've been your host, Blake Howard. Thank you to Stu Coote and Garth Franklin. Their details are in the show notes. And now, there he is. He's being good. He's activated his phone. We're in position. Episode 6 of Row Min is coming up soon.